To quote an American Bar Association article, American college campuses have long been proffered as safe places to freely exchange and discuss ideas. However, they have since become bastions of censorship of free speech and expression. We sat down with Jonathan Zimmerman, an author and history professor at the University of Pennsylvania, to discuss the current state of free speech on college campuses, hate speech, political correctness, and the impact of social media on the freedom of speech.
I'm a historian, and my specialty is the history of American education of schools and universities. And a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Campus Politics, which tried to analyze what was happening in late 2015, the protests that stemmed from Yale and other places, in a kind of broader historical perspective.
In today's world, is there a problem with free speech on college campuses? And if so, what's going on?
Well, there is a problem, but I think the problem in some ways is misstated and misperceived. I think if you would read some accounts of campuses, especially those accounts that come from the right, they're viewed as these kind of totalitarian places where a certain kind of liberal orthodoxy is enforced and anybody who breaches it is slapped down or penalized with some sort of hate speech fine. I think a lot of that is overstated. But in the same breath, I want to emphasize I do think there's a free speech problem on campus, and the real problem is that people self-censor. So it's not that there are all these police walking around who are enforcing some sort of orthodoxy, but there are, I think, more subtle pressures on people to tailor their speech to what's acceptable or correct, and I do think that's a problem.
Is hate speech real, and how would you define hate speech?
Well, look, of course hate speech is real, and I don't have to define hate speech because there's a 40-year body of law about it. We don't have to reinvent the wheel here, okay? There have been a whole slew of federal court cases that have analyzed hate speech, and I think most importantly for our conversation, have found it protected under the First Amendment. One of the other big misperceptions that strikes me on our American campuses is that hate speech is illegal. I mean, we can poll students and they'll say hate speech is illegal. Look, you can make an argument that it should be illegal and I'll listen. But if you say it's illegal or unconstitutional, that's just like saying 1 and 1 is 3. It isn't. Speakers and listeners should decide, not governments or university administrators. I think that In a society of diversity, we're obviously going to differ in the different ways that we react to things and even in the different ways we conceptualize hate itself. And I certainly don't want a university administrator making that judgment, and I definitely don't want the president of the United States, especially the current president, making that judgment.
In a previous lecture, based on a survey, you shared that 40% of full-time faculty silently oppose the use of race and admissions. What are your thoughts on this form of self-censorship?
Well, let me emphasize, it's not all silent. I mean, there are some faculty that oppose the use of race in college admissions openly. But what I think is important about the statistic is that I think it's surprising. That's what's important about it, and also depressing. Let me explain. I was surprised when I saw that survey literature because I haven't heard very many of that 40%. So to be clear, the majority of faculty support the use of race in college admissions. And I should say, just for the sake of disclosure, I support it as well. But I'm nevertheless depressed to hear the 40% number, not because there were faculty that disagreed with me, but because I wasn't hearing from them. And what that means is that they are self-censoring. And I don't see how that can be good for the university or even for affirmative action, which, as I see it, is a salutary phenomenon, but could only be enhanced and flourish by a full debate about it. And if people aren't saying what's on their mind, we're not going to have that full debate.
I mean, should people be free to share and have unpopular views on politics, religion, nations, laws, et cetera?
I'm sorry to laugh. I mean, it seems to me that the founding principle of the modern university is yes. Should they be free? Well, if you look at the first statement by the AAUP about academic freedom in 1915, what they say is yes to your question. And the reason is that we can't get closer to truth. We can't develop knowledge unless everybody is free to express what they're writing, thinking, and doing.
Now, you have described in one lecture there being two types of political correctness. Can you explain the difference between the two?
Yes, I call them PC1 and PC2. And PC1 is a set of social sanctions that discourage us from, using slurs. I think what you were calling earlier outright hate speech. I don't think it should be illegal to use the N-word. I think people that use terms like that should be shamed. And in that sense, I think the use of slurs like that should be politically incorrect. That is, not illegal, but strongly and negatively sanctioned by our collective norms, especially at the university. But to go back to our earlier example, I think PC2 is much more problematic because it involves sanctions against the expression of ideas, not simply slurs. So to return to our early example about affirmative action, I think it's fair to say that in the affirmative action debate, PC2 is operating insofar as there is a legitimate case and there are important, interesting disagreements about affirmative action, but we're not hearing all sides of it because PC2 is operating to inhibit people from expressing ideas. I've got no problem with a political correctness that discourages people from using outright slurs. But I have a deep problem with the political correctness that discourages people from expressing ideas, especially on highly controverted and complicated political issues.
Now, in one of your lectures, you described there being a problem with the rise of psychological terms, idioms, and metaphors for discussing politics. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, yes, and let me be clear from the start that I'm not against psychology. My family and I have been great beneficiaries of psychology. I won't share the details. But I don't think psychology and politics play well together. And to give you a direct example, if you were to listen to me in this conversation, say that you were microaggressed or triggered by something I said, I have essentially one thing to say in response, Charles. I'm sorry. I suppose I could ask you for more elaboration about why you feel offended. But the point is, I couldn't and never would deny your feeling. And that's precisely what makes it such a poor idiom for political discussion. When I try to make this point, often my students say, you're denying our feelings. And that's false. It's the opposite. It's precisely the undeniability of feeling that makes it such a poor venue for political discussion. Political discussion, by definition, requires a certain sort of denial or rejection or rebuffing. But if we're working in the field of feeling, we can't really do that because we can't look into each other's souls and deny what the other is feeling, and I never would.
How do you really define microaggression? I know we hear that term all the time today. How would you define a microaggression?
Well, in my book, I go into the genealogy of it, and it has an academic genealogy. It was coined by a psychiatrist at Harvard, an African-American guy named Clarence Pierce in circa 1970. To connote, he said, small, often inadvertent and unintended slights that nevertheless in a cumulative way add up to create difficulty for the targets of those slights. So they were micro because they were small, they were often unintended, but in sum, they often added up to a burden that minorities had to bear, an unfair and often a psychologically debilitating burden. But the term didn't really catch on until the aughts, until the 2000s. A guy at Teachers College named Daryl Wing Su started publishing books and glossaries of microaggressions. And what's interesting about the glossaries is that the microaggressions fall into two different and in some ways opposite camps or categories. One set of microaggressions is bad because it highlights people's difference unfairly. So where are you from? Or Asians are good at math. These are allegedly microaggressions because they highlight people's difference in an unfair or offensive way. But what's interesting about the glossary is that there's another category of microaggressions that are bad because they erase difference. So when I look at you, I don't see race. There's only one race, the human race. America is a melting pot. Remember, these are not my inventions. This is from the glossary. These microaggressions are problematic, allegedly, not because they highlight difference, but because they erase it.
You know, social media is is everywhere today. What is the impact of social media on the freedom of speech today?
Well, again, there's a huge literature on this, and I would say that one of the takeaways of the literature is that when you're online, you're less restrained in what you will say, quote unquote, and what you'll express than face-to-face. And so one thing that's absolutely clear is that certain forms of social media have encouraged uncivil and indeed sometimes hateful statements and behavior that many people wouldn't actually engage in face-to-face. And I do think that's a really important context for a lot of these discussions, because I think that that sort of behavior online, without question, has made some people quite wary of engaging in politics at all, because on social media they've witnessed the kind of anger, hatred, and vilification that's often a part of these political discussions. I think it's also very complicated because even though they are private enterprises, I also think it's fair to say that they now have public duties and responsibilities. And I think that all of us as a country are trying to come to grips with that and what it means. The New Yorker just published a great profile of Mark Zuckerberg by Evan Osnos. And for me, the takeaway of that is that Zuckerberg came up thinking we're just a private company. It's not really our duty to monitor or regulate any of this stuff. And I think that Zuckerberg has been weaned off that. And he now acknowledges that Facebook does have some sort of duty to address and possibly even improve political discourse. And I think he and everyone else is struggling with how to do that. Look, I'm a historian. I have a hard enough time figuring out what happened in the past. Getting into the future. I will say that I think we're in an extremely brittle, intense moment for free speech in our country. I do think social media is part of that story, but I think the biggest part of the story is that Americans have isolated themselves ideologically. They've lost the skills, many of us, that are involved in civil exchange because we live in communities where we don't interact with people of different political parties. And we consume media that's tailored to us that doesn't, again, engage us with other points of view. So we have not learned, or lots of us have lost, the capacity to carry on civil political discussions. And I think there's a lot of evidence for that. What to do about that, I think, is the most pressing political and social question of our day.
We're sort of living in our own bubbles, like whether Facebook, Twitter, like we're getting fed information that sort of, I guess, confirmation bias, if you will. So we're in our own bubble, you know.
Correct.
And so what is the danger of that as far as, I guess, the lack of diversity of opinion?
Oh, I think the danger is enormous. I think that we're living the danger right now. And I think you can see it in the style of name-calling and mutual vilification that pervades our political sphere. Donald Trump is not the only reason for that. He's as much a product of it as anything else. But he is the president, and he has ginned it up, right? We've never had a president who gets on Twitter and calls people morons. That's never happened in the history of America. And surely that's an important and deeply troubling phenomenon. But I would say that because Trump is president, he has both the biggest responsibility and represents the biggest danger to our discourse. But I would say the second biggest danger is the rest of us are imitating it. And I think you see this everywhere, including on college campuses. You know, you're a homophobe, you're a transphobe, you're a racist, you're a mansplainer, you're a white-splainer. My students who engage in that, I always say, you know, a few minutes ago you were telling me you were part of the resistance against Trump. It's a pretty strange and effed up way to resist a guy, to act like him. Don't be like him. Don't be like him. That's the challenge right now. The challenge is our president is somebody who is violated every day formally accepted and consensual norms of civic discourse. And the danger is that we become like him.
How can we move forward? What would you say to a group of people who are shouting at each other to encourage them to come together? And what would you say to the group?
You know, that's the question of the day. And all I can tell you is what I've tried to do and what I've encouraged other people to do. The first thing is, as best you can, try to engage with the other side, especially the other side's media. So, Charles, I'll tell you, when I go to the gym, I have an exclusive diet of Fox News. I only watch Fox News. And the reason is I'm a liberal Democrat. And I know that if I watch CNN or MSNBC, I will just have all of my presuppositions confirmed. All right? By watching Fox News, I'm actually exposed to the other side. And I'll tell you something. Like most prejudices, it turns out my prejudice against Fox News was grounded in ignorance. It's true that some people on Fox News are just straight-out propagandists for Trump, and they've in fact admitted it. But Fox News, like, turns out it's kind of a diverse place. I mean, you know, obviously it's a Republican shop, but there are Democrats on Fox News. There are people of color on Fox News. Once you get out of your bubble, you start to see that actually on the other side, things aren't necessarily as singular as you would imagine. So that's one thing, is as best you can expose yourself to other ways of thinking. And then I would just say support institutions, especially schools and universities, that are trying to do something about this, because they are. You know, there are initiatives where I work and other places to try to create dialogue across difference. And, you know, we all get the democracy that we deserve. And unless we support people that are trying to promote dialogue across difference, we won't get it.
Are there any thought leaders, whether it's researchers, professors, politicians, bloggers, anyone that you would recommend who's listening to this to follow in this space?
Oh, look, there's lots of activity going on with this. I mean, if you go to the website of Heterodox Academy, you'll see that, you know, they have different online tools that help you do precisely what I'm describing, right? Which is, you know, with titles like the Open Mind Initiative, that expose you in a deliberate way to other ways of seeing the world. And so even by the name Heterodox Academy, you can see what their bailiwick is, right? I mean, they're trying to promote more ideological diversity and most of all, more discussion across diverse points of view. So this is happening, and there are other campus initiatives, some of them student-run, to try to do this. So with a few clicks of the mouse, you can find it. I think the harder question is what to do about people that don't want to engage. You know, I think that all we can do, those of us who want to promote discourse, is keep making that plea and keep trying, even in this polarized environment, to get people to talk.
There's a term you hear, white privilege. Is it real? And if you're a white cisgender male, like, are you by default racist?
Those are two different questions, okay, that you just asked, right? One was, is white privilege real? And the other is, if you're a white person, are you by default racist? I don't think they're the same question, okay? The first question is, white privilege real? It depends how you define it. Certainly, whites have been able to exercise certain privileges in this country that other people haven't, right? So when I go into a store, generally people's eyes don't follow me thinking I might steal something. It's much more likely, although not not assured, but much more likely, and there's plenty of research to back this up, that if you go into a place as a black person, eyes are much more likely to trail you. Okay? So I think it's fair to say that I exert a sort of privilege because I don't have to face that. Okay? But to take your second question, it's preposterous to say that because I have that advantage, I'm racist, because the second claim speaks to my state of mind rather than to what sort of advantages I might exert. I don't think we want to meld those two things.
Of the freedom of speech.
Our dangers and our opportunities.
This is our challenge. And this is our time.
It really is a revolution.